WFP.org.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On Friday, the Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare with the American Health Care Act failed. Not because of opposition by Democrats, though all of them were opposed. The bill failed because of opposition by Republicans, who dealt a severe blow to two of their own, House Speaker Paul Ryan and President Trump. The GOP controls the White House and both houses of Congress, and yet their signature bill and their long-standing promise to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act did nothing but highlight cracks within the party. In Raleigh, legislators face a deadline, probably this week, to repeal HB 2. The NCAA is scheduled to decide on the location of its championship games through 2022, and if HB 2 remains on the books, those games will not be played here. Republicans who recognize the economic injury the bill is doing to the state can't bring themselves to repeal it without compromises that Democrats find untenable. And recently, a Democrat who put forth a proposal that might find favor with Republicans discovered that our Democratic governor, who initially expressed some support for the proposal, tacked to the left and withdrew that support. We've reached the stage where it isn't only Republicans fighting Democrats. We are now witnessing members of each party battling members of their own. We've been building to this for a while, but with the swearing in of Donald Trump, the troubles faced by both sides have escalated. So we're going to take a closer look at all of this. Three of our go-to political scientists are here. Dr. Michael Bitzer is professor of political science and provost at Catawba College. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Dr. Susan Roberts, an associate professor of political science at Davidson College, is also in our studio. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Dr. Andrew Taylor, professor of political science at NC State, North Carolina State University, is with us by phone. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And if folks would like to join us, you can get to us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. The headline in yesterday's New York Times read, "Trump becomes ensnared in fiery GOP civil war." Susan Roberts, is that what led to the defeat of the Health Care Act?
Well, I mean, how I'm going to describe it to my students in very simple terms, and that is substance, symbol, and signal. And I think the substance was one of the things that the Republicans had 7 years to try to get this ready. He promised it. They knew it was coming. And I think that was one of the factors people are talking about. I think we'll look at this. This is going to be there in the budget talks, and that is how this has an impact on Trump's base, not the people across the board. All Trump voters are not the same, but the base of people that really made up their minds early on that Trump was the man. I think it signals a lot for what's going to happen with this agenda. And as there's so many things to talk about, and we could talk about this the whole time, but I think it is something that was a defeat for Trump. Who was he listening to? Didn't he know this was coming? Paul Ryan, as we all know, said when he assumed the nomination and the leadership said, "I'll do this if you all play nice." And that was the Freedom Caucus.
But is this – are we witnessing a civil war? And if it's a civil war, is it a civil war – is it just between the American – the Freedom Caucus and the rest of the Republican Party? Or are there other factions as well? Is it between Trump and Congress? What's the civil war?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of – that you can classify these groups into. I think that there's the issue of the moderates that are still left within the Republican conference in the House versus the House Freedom Caucus. They're both probably about 30 to 40 members, but that could have significant ramifications if a policy decision like this health care bill went too far to the right. The House Freedom Caucus is going to be supportive of it, but you're going to lose the moderates. If you compromise and go to the middle, perhaps, the moderates will be with you. The House Freedom Caucus will be alienated. I think a lot of this is ideology versus just pragmatic governance style. And what do people want to be able to do?
Yeah, the House Freedom Caucus is about 36 socially and fiscally conservative Republicans, and they're led by a North Carolinian.
Mark Meadows.
Andy Taylor. I lost my question. No, that never happened.
Well, Andy's written a book on the Republican Party.
Yeah, well, and here's my question. Here's my question. If you're going to be the party of no with President Obama in the White House, with the Freedom Caucus leading that charge, can you govern in that same way, or does the Freedom Caucus have to back off?
Well, it is a difficult transition. Obviously, we've had 8 years of Democratic president, and even though Republicans have enjoyed majorities for most of that time in both the House and Senate, the onus hasn't been on them on governing. It's largely been on trying to block and sometimes change the Obama agenda. Now, with a Republican in the White House, the onus is on them governing. And there's two difficult things here. One is that transition from those two strategic positions, now having to offer stuff. And I think Susan mentioned it in the answer to her question, that they had, you know, there were 7 years when the Republicans knew that they wanted to get rid of Obamacare, but there was never a coming together on an alternative plan. And then the second thing that's caused a problem is Donald Trump. The Republican president that Republicans finally have isn't really a conventional Republican. He has different, divergent views from sort of Republican orthodoxy, particularly on many economic issues. And so you've got this new governing coalition where the onus and responsibility is on them to get things done. And they really can't come to an agreement on details, at least.
Donald Trump is also
what they want to do.
Donald Trump is also not a traditional politician, mm-hmm. and is that part of the problem? He has not spent the last 30 or 40 years of his life ensnared or engulfed in the process in Washington, D.C. He's the outsider. He's the businessman coming in. So should he know, can he possibly know how all of this stuff works behind the scenes?
Well, I think, you know, he should have anticipated that he was going to have trouble. You don't
Well, he does have Reince Priebus as his chief
of staff. You don't anticipate that you're going to go into a contested convention without realizing that you've got a lot of people that weren't sure about you being president. This whole mess about pulling the Health Care Act, it really is one of those things that strikes to two things, and that is his art of the deal. And secondly, and we can't escape this, the populist promises that he made that make it seem simple.
Well, let's talk about that, because while campaigning and again as president, Donald Trump promised that health care would be easy and that the end result would be health care that would cover more people, be cheaper, have better quality. And even before the Republican bill was defeated, we all knew that wasn't going to be true. It wasn't – I'm going to say that as loud and clear. Yep. It was not going to happen. And yet he worked to get this bill passed. It was estimated that 24 million people, if this had passed, would lose coverage ultimately, and the costs for the poor and older Americans would rise. Yet he worked to get this passed. This does not jibe with what he promised. So what message does this send?
Well, I think part of it is that he is a big picture president. He likes to work in this kind of vague, symbolic, you know, things are going to be great and things are going to be wonderful. And when you get into governance, you have to get into the weeds.
Could he not have crafted this? Could he not have get involved, not just in having Congress pass what Paul Ryan wrote, but to say, no, This doesn't match what I promised, so let's work to match what I promised.
But when does he get into the details? When does he get into the weeds? When has he ever come out with a specific –
But don't you have to? And aren't you ultimately going to lose your followers?
Exactly. But you have to be willing to put in the effort, like what – say good or bad about what Obama did for the ACA. It took them over a year to get the details and to get the compromising and, yes, to get the deal-making. Remember, Donald Trump said, I am a deal maker. I wrote the art of the deal. And he even said at his announcement speech, if you can't make a deal with a politician, what good are you? Well, there you are.
Well, I think, too, he passed executive – or he signed executive orders without clearing them through his own presidency. And this may sound trivial, and it's a real short statement. One of his ideas was working with the Freedom Caucus was to bring them in, feed them pizza, and let them go bowling. That doesn't even work with undergraduates.
Andrew Taylor, is there a political price to pay at some point, maybe not here, but at some point when the promises that the president made, and he made some very big promises about infrastructure, about the jobs, about health care, and it goes on, when those things don't happen, is there a political price to pay? Will he pay the price, or are people so much in love with him that they don't care.
No, I think this is a serious setback for the president and the broader agenda. This was supposed to be low-hanging fruit. This was something that was at the top of the list of things to do. It was supposed to be something the Republicans were united on. The ordering was important as well, because this health care reform was going to go through under the fiscal 27 reconciliation legislation, and with the repeal of the tax increases was supposed to provide some revenue in order to help.
Right.
With the tax reform that was supposed to come second, and they were going to use the reconciliation process for fiscal 18. So by losing this, not only do you lose your credibility, not only do you not, at least in for the immediate term, get rid of Obamacare, but you've also created some more constraints in trying to get tax reform passed.
Well, so
this was you can't really dress it up. And that's one of the reasons it surprises me. I mean, this is the easiest hurdle, right? This is the House. And this was the first stage of the process. So really, all they needed to do was to get something passed and try to work out further down the road in the Senate or in conference some of the details. But the president was unwilling or unable, and Speaker Ryan was unwilling or unable to just get anything passed the House and then try to deal with it later on.
Well, explain that, because Paul Ryan, they have tried, House Republicans have tried 52 times to repeal Obamacare. They had over seven years to mm-hmm. figure out what they would replace it with when they started talking about repealing and replacing. And they had a presidential candidate who talked loud and clear at every single rally that he would repeal and replace Obamacare. Why didn't they have a plan they could all agree on after 7 years? And what does that tell us about the Republican Party at the moment, Dr. Taylor?
Well, there should have been one, and there were people, there were sensible conservatives who were really thinking seriously about one. But the president, particularly, didn't. The administration didn't have one. Obamacare is broadly unpopular, but possible alternatives aren't exactly popular either. And so it made sense to, you know, campaign on this. Republicans had successful campaigns in 2010, 2014, and 2016 on repeal of Obamacare. But there was never the sort of need to come up with a alternative that could get broad support in the Republican Party. And, that has been shown by the events of last week. And It is, I think, a huge strategic error.
Would it be correct to say, Dr. Bitzer, that what the plan that we saw that they were going to vote on that was yanked at the last minute on Friday was the Paul Ryan plan that Paul Ryan had put together over the course of the last several years?
It seemed like it, and it looked like he was trying to cut deals with the House Freedom Caucus to make it even more conservative to their liking, and it imploded upon itself.
Well, Paul Ryan is in office as Speaker of the House because primarily the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party ousted John Boehner, mm-hmm. former Speaker, and they are the Freedom Caucus, mm-hmm. which is probably why he didn't want the job initially, anyway, because
who would?
You can't placate.
No, you can't.
You can't maneuver with these people because they are not moving.
Right.
So he surely had to know that. How does he recover from this in 20 seconds?
I think it's going to be tough. And if he decides he's had enough, like John Boehner, who leads the House? I think that is the great unknown at this point.
Okay, more to talk about both in politics nationally and here in North Carolina. When we come back, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Goodwill Industries of the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to breaking barriers to employment, training job seekers, and offering health care and banking at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.org. And the Pump House Restaurant, featuring a Southern-inspired cuisine in a restored multi-level pump house with a rooftop bar located at the Riverwalk in Rock Hill. More info at rockhillpumphouse.com. Best-selling novelist Greg Iles has released the final book in his Natchez Burning trilogy about a prosecutor in the South. The series covers murder, civil rights history, and hate crimes inspired by real-life events. And Greg Iles will join guest host Eric Spanberg to talk about the trilogy, the events behind it, the research that went into writing it, and the accident that turned what was supposed to be one book into three. Tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Congress is striking down internet privacy rules from the Obama years. We'll look at why and what it means for your life online. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up at 10, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Michael Bitzer, frequent host of this program from Catawba College, political scientist there, Dr. Susan Roberts, political scientist at Davidson College, and Dr. Andrew Taylor, political scientist at North Carolina State University. Prior to this health care bill being pulled on Friday, Donald Trump singled out U.S. Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina. He is the conservative chairman of the House Freedom Caucus who led the opposition to the bill. And he told Meadows in a meeting prior to the bill being pulled, Mark, I'm going to come after you big time. Is that a jab or a threat?
That was a threat. And Mark wanted to be on the bill, wanted to support it. And when you – even if you are president of the United States and you walk in with a core group of members of the House that you have got to have to pass a bill, you do not walk in there and threaten, because basically they'll say – now, remind me again who you are. You are not a member of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Uh-huh.
You may be president, but you ain't a member of the House.
So is this a case of the tail wagging the dog, and is Donald Trump, the supreme negotiator, the businessman, the billionaire, used to the tail wagging the dog?
Well, I think he may be. I mean, I think when you look at Mark Meadows, he has been in office since 2013, if I'm not mistaken. His wife had a bus in the mountains, Women for Trump. And so it wasn't as if he wasn't on board with the election. I just think – excuse me – that many times we look at what we used to call the norm of apprenticeship, and that worked in the Senate, not so much in the House. But everybody can be a free agent. It's not necessarily party.
But
it's partisanship.
But if, as you say, he campaigned for Donald Trump to be president. Donald Trump is the president. He is the Republican president, the first one they've had in 8 years. He's a guy with who has high hopes among those who voted for him. Why would you cripple him at the start?
Well, I think, you know, he put this out and it was controversial from the beginning. And some people said they just couldn't couldn't strip some of the Obama. It was Obamacare light. And then was it Trump care, Ryan care? It was just a mess from the get-go. And I don't know why he started with this. I think that he's not going to have – the budget is going to be – tax reform just as controversial. I don't see how that can pass the muster when it has so many things.
We're going to talk about that next. So Mark Meadows of North Carolina was opposed to this bill, while North Carolina's Patrick McHenry from the 10th District, Andy Taylor, was tasked with whipping up support. What does that tell us either about either man or about voters in North Carolina that we got these two extreme ends of the spear here?
Yeah, well, it also says a lot about the Republican Party in that now it's a governing party. Like most governing parties, it's a large, diverse group of people with heterogeneous views who are going to fight with one another once in a while. And it is interesting that now we do have, and it's been a long time that we've had members of the House delegation from the state who have been in the national spotlight and who seem, you know, who are influencing the national agenda. We mentioned Meadows as chair of the Freedom Caucus, only in his third term in Congress, and now seen as a sort of linchpin in the House. You mentioned Pat McHenry, the 10th District, who's been there since after the 2004 election and has emerged as an important player in the leadership. Virginia Fox is chair of the Education Committee now. So we have people throughout the House Republican in the North Carolina delegation, throughout the House Republican conference, in different positions, leadership outside. It demonstrates that the party is having some transition issues to governing, as we said earlier on. And North Carolina, the North Carolina delegation reflects that.
There was a lot of conversation beginning on, I guess, Thursday and Friday and through the weekend about the great negotiator, the art of the deal guy, Donald Trump, not being able to pull off this deal. But not every deal goes through, and even great negotiators sometimes meet with oppositions that they either cannot or choose not to overcome. What's the case here, do you think?
Well, one of the things that you learn, I mean, we teach in the presidency is you have, quote unquote, political capital. And that's really determined by your majorities in the House and the Senate. And he has those numbers. I think there was another book that people referred to that maybe second or third one down about the comeback deal or what do you do, the art of the comeback. Mm-hmm. He dug his own grave by saying, I can do this, and this is how I can do it. He did not drain the swamp. He is not, and this is another promise, we're going to win. We're going to win so much, you're going to say, oh, please stop winning. You can't keep saying that thing. It's, you know, some of these things are read my lips, no new taxes. You get yourself into a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Mike, I was just going to say, I also think that one of the things that, and it does seem strange that they cut, you know, cut bait pretty quickly here, just on Friday. I mean, they could have just put this on the back burner and worked over the next couple of weeks to try to get something through. But Trump wanted to give up, seems pretty easily and pretty early. And I think some of that is because he genuinely believes that Obamacare is dead and that it will kill itself. It will just sort of wither on the vine.
Well,
and
he
create said, the kind of momentum for a repeal later on. I think he genuinely believes that.
He said, he said it before we saw the plan, and he said it after the plan was withdrawn, that the best thing that Republicans could do would be for Obamacare to continue because it's going to explode or implode, whichever word you want to use, and then the Democrats will own it. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Is any of that true? Will it implode, and will the Democrats then own it if it does? Because a lot of the problems with Obamacare, it seems to me, were caused by Republicans or the need to compromise to get it through Congress with Republicans.
I'm one of those people who thinks it's seriously flawed and will cause problems. You see it already. You know, the Republican plan would have cut the amount of people covered. But as a practical matter, there are large numbers of people now who are covered, who aren't really covered just because they can't afford to go to the doctor under their current plan. But the real problem with this failure, this legislative failure, is this question of ownership. Yes, you could. The president probably will say Obamacare is going to fail and the Democrats own it. But the Republicans have clearly, in front of the American people now, missed a prime opportunity to do something about it. And so now I think in the minds of the average American voter, they may just be as culpable and they may share ownership of Obamacare with the Democrats because of the failure of last week.
Some have suggested that because of this intransigence on the part of the – I keep forgetting the name of the caucus, the House Freedom Caucus, and the inability to get things done because they will not budge, that Donald Trump's best hope is to now – move and focus his attention on the Democrats and find a way to work with moderate Democrats. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, that's going to be hard, but that would fundamentally, I think, start the reshifting potentially of American politics. Simply, if Donald Trump continued in the populist vein that he was able to tap into, I think he could start to make entries into Democrats who want to work with him on fixing Obamacare.
Infrastructure,
the budget. You know, there are a lot of things that there is a lot of potential for groups to come together, but they have to be willing to set aside some things. And there's a lot of negativism. You did this to me, so I'm going to do this to you.
And
there's retribution, and that's the danger of our politics.
And there are enough Democrats to overcome the 36 Freedom Caucus members?
I'm not sure. I really don't think so in terms of all the people that he has insulted over the course of the election. And also, I mean, think about this. It's still very, you know, loosely defined, the Freedom Caucus. Until recently, people didn't really know who was in it and who was out of it. I think in terms of the infrastructure, which Schumer and others have said, we can work with him on this. But the budget slash tax reform has programs in it. He's cutting programs that would help infrastructure in some cash-poor cities like Detroit. And It's almost as if it's put forth and let the pieces fall where they may. This is a good idea, but let's not look at the details.
Yeah.
And the details in this omnibus legislation are what can kill it.
The reason I asked whether Democrats could make up the difference is because after the bill was pulled, Donald Trump blamed the Democrats.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the Democrats in the Freedom Caucus.
But then he turned on the Freedom Caucus over the weekend, and particularly the Heritage Club, Club for Growth. And in fact, one of the members of the House Freedom Caucus publicly resigned, Ted Poe, I think it was, resigned over this policy difference.
Okay. So. Mark Halperin, a political consultant for NBC News who has his own show on HBO called The Circus, says this defeat probably makes it impossible for Donald Trump to have a major legislative achievement in this term. Do you agree with that? And if so, what will that mean for the Trump presidency, for his party, for his followers, for the country? I mean, this is 4 years we're talking about here. And if he has no legislative achievements in this term, wouldn't that end his presidency?
Well, and this is the time that the president should get things done. The
first 100
proverbial days. 100 days. But I think, too, Trump is looking back and seeing, this is what I promised. Why can't I do it? One thing, I'll just inject this, it may not even be in context, but what was fascinating is that he tweeted on, I think, Saturday, watch this show, I'm a big fan of Fox.
Yeah.
And the whole show was about, this is Paul Ryan's fault. He should resign. He should be kicked out. And so that's another signal that what's going on within the party.
Yeah. He's made all these blustery promises, and you just mentioned Twitter. Since coming into office, he has seemingly focused on his Twitter feed, addressing slights real and imagined, accusing his predecessor of wiretapping Trump Tower, something all security agencies have now denied, and the list goes on and on and on. Is he his own worst enemy? Is this kind of activity interfering with his ability to get things done? Or to be able to wield the hammer of the presidency?
Usually you tend to see a presidency start off with a very clear, cogent, and coherent message and agenda. This is what we want to accomplish, and we are going to buckle in and really start moving forward. And the president stays on message. The president puts forward the vision. He uses what we call the bully pulpit. He tries to rally public opinion to push things through in Congress. I'm at a loss to compare this start of a presidential administration to any other presidency because it is so abnormal compared to what we traditionally, Democratic or Republican, tend to see.
Well, Andrew Taylor, going back to that Mark Halperin comment that he doesn't think that he will have it, this makes it impossible for Trump to have any legislative achievement in this term. Has something this crushing, because the term crushing has been used as in regard to this defeat on Friday, has something like this happened in the first 100 days of a presidential administration in the past, and did that person recover?
Well, not recently, that's for sure. I mean, it's Trump comes in with, he's a minority president, didn't win a plurality of the national popular vote. His approval ratings are pretty low. We've already talked a lot about him not sort of being a conventional Republican and therefore not having the sort of ideological ties with a lot of the Republicans in Washington. He also is not a politician, so he hasn't cultivated strong relationships with Republicans at the national level. He comes in as an outsider. He comes in as someone who says to the American people that I can solve problems. He has his initial failure. There does seem to be a lack of clarity in what he's trying to do. There's a whiff of scandal. I mean, this is not an auspicious beginning by any stretch of the imagination. I don't know if Halperin's right about his prediction, but by the virtue of the fact that people are already talking about it, this is not good. And if you compare it to the Bush first 100 days, and Bush was in a worse strategic position with Congress. The Senate was split 50-50 in 2001, and in fact, the Democrats actually took control in May with a defection of a Republican senator. And yet, a really ambitious tax cut proposal went through Congress. Bush got it done. Trump isn't starting off as strong as Bush did. He's not starting off as strong as Obama did. There is, I think, reason to be concerned that this is an administration that's losing momentum very quickly.
And momentum is very important, particularly with presidential administrations. But is this not only a problem with momentum in the administration, but a crisis, a structural crisis within the GOP?
Well, excuse me. I think it is a crisis within the GOP. But I really think people should have seen some of this coming with, and I hate to say it again, with the election, the Republican primary. Speeches at the convention were fraught with personal and political kinds of accusations.
Because Democrats were set to become the party of no. I think many of them had decided that the best way to fight all this was to do what the Republicans did to President Obama and become the party of no. In this scenario, can they afford to be the party of no, or do they have to start putting forth good populist, and I use that term loosely. I don't mean populist in a pejorative sense, but good policy initiatives that speak to the people that they lost in this election.
Well, I think that you have to look around, and I still get back to political intuition and what the politicians that he has in his circle. He should have been listening. He should have seen Lindsey Graham and the town halls. He had the town halls all across the country instead of the masses and the rallies that he's had. He should look at that and say, this is complicated. And I think we look at legislation today, and it's very complicated.
Well, who knew that health care could be so complicated? Oklahoma Republican Representative Tom Cole said prior to the health care bill being pulled that if the bill failed, you have to go back to square one and rethink your entire legislative schedule. Do you agree with that, Dr. Bitzer? And if so, why? The entire schedule?
Well, the entire schedule is probably up for flux because how do you put together a governing coalition in one chamber and be able to get it passed in the second chamber? And, you know, the whole dynamic coming out of the House was even if they passed it, there was no way that it was going to get through the Senate because of, again, moderate Republicans there. So, yeah, this and remember, we are in this honeymoon period, this kind of this what should be a lot of action going on. By the time June or July starts rolling around, guess what everybody's going to start thinking? 2018's election.
Right. Trump says he will now turn his attention to tax reform, but some say that's not possible because much of the ability to maneuver in that area was tied up in the $1 trillion that was going to be wiped out with the wiping out of Obamacare and the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. As Paul Ryan has said, that now remains the law of the land for the foreseeable future. So can meaningful tax reform be embarked upon?
Well, you know, that's what I was saying earlier on with the ordering of it under the budget procedures, Mike, that it was important to go with Obamacare for repeal for a number of reasons, but that was one. And now you lose a lot of revenue that you want to use in tax reform. There's also a massive debate going on with the Republican Party, particularly over the border adjustment tax that the Trump administration wants to pass. A lot more sort of libertarian-minded Republicans in Congress are not interested in doing that. They think it crimps trade and growth. So that's going to be another philosophical battle that's going to occur within the party. And, you know, given what happened last week, it's not a great start. So, I think both practically because of the loss in revenue that would have been gained by doing the Obamacare repeal first, and secondly,
we're coming right back. Stand by. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cal Atlantic Homes, featuring four villages plus five new floor plans in the community of Braden in the Fort Mill School District. Braden offers a private residence club, pool, and playground. CalAtlanticHomes.com. And Central Piedmont Community College's Collegiate Test Prep, offering evening GRE exam preparation classes starting April 4th at CPCC's Levine Campus in Matthews. Details at CollegiateTestPrep.com. The dust continues to settle in Washington after the unraveling of the Republican push to repeal the Affordable Care Act. We're talking about it. Guess who else is talking about it? Tom Ashbrook and his guest talking about it next on Point, what's next for healthcare policy and the Trump presidency. That's all upcoming. And if you'd like to jump in on our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks.
When the news breaks, there are plenty of questions to answer. That's why NPR News stays with the story.
Minnesota argued the president's order, issued just over a week ago, is unconstitutional.
A situation where the security of our country is at stake.
They have refused to lift that temporary restraining order in President Trump's policy.
For news of the first 100 days that goes beyond the headlines, listen every day.
News matters. Stay connected at 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Dr. Susan Roberts from Davidson College, and Dr. Andrew Taylor from NC State University. I had to interrupt you in the middle of a point, doctor, so finish your point and we'll move
yeah,
on.
Yeah, sorry about
That's
that,
okay.
Mike. I got carried away. I just saying that the practical side of not getting Obamacare repealed through is problematic for the tax reform because they lose a lot of the revenue. And then, of course, also the issue of trust. Amongst Republicans is diminished somewhat by the failure as well. So, this has significant negative impacts for the tax reform.
So tax reform, it would seem to me, and I don't know this, you know better than I, would be just as tricky as health care. There are factions who want certain things out of tax reform. Is it as hard as health care?
Oh, God, yes.
Yes, I think it is. And I think, again, the people that may not read it all the way down, I mean, Mick Mulvaney made some very, I think, you know, careless comments about how do I explain to the people in West Virginia about Sesame Street and PBS and all the things that would be in this tax reform package. And he's cutting with a broad brush. Military spending up, Homeland Security up, VA up. But then he's going to cut so many programs. And I think people don't realize. I actually looked we had a long task of things to look at, but one of the things that would be cut is this American Museum and Support or Library. And in the face of it, if you look at what Trump said about going to the Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, great thing. And then he would cut the program that helped support that
right.
agency or that museum.
There seems to be a disconnect on some things. But would it be smarter or easier for Republicans and the president to now pivot to another Trump promise as opposed to going to the taxes to go to infrastructure spending? Because
yes.
on that, he could get Democratic support.
I think that could be the potential leadway. The problem, as Andy correctly pointed out, is where's their trust? Where's their willingness to work on both sides? And it's going to take a lot to really kind of bridge the divide that is between the two parties, let alone within the two
parties.
But if
you're going to put working people back to work on these infrastructure mm-hmm. projects, building bridges, improving airports, doing road work, et cetera, that is the traditional Democratic coalition. Would they stand in the way of that? Just to be politically stubborn?
Well, I think they might or they might not. I think if you look at some of the promises about Keystone and all the jobs that would create, some of those are very temporary jobs. I do think infrastructure is one of the things that the Democrats may agree on, but also it's where those infrastructure projects might be. I think the Democrats, again, as Michael said and so many others, it's the polarization, the calcification of ideology that has seeped down from Washington to the public, and individuals don't want to budge. And I think that's going to be even more difficult. Bipartisanship doesn't always guarantee a better bill. And most of the time what they do is they cherry pick three or four Democrats and call it bipartisanship.
And the problem with the infrastructure bill is going to be just like what they have done away with in Congress, the earmarking. Who's going to get their pet project?
Right.
And if this person gets their pet project and this person doesn't, guess where the votes fall?
Is that part of the problem with all of this, Andrew Taylor, the elimination of earmarks several years ago when congressmen could no longer put their little pet projects, sneak them into bills, and get something good for their district? That doesn't happen as much anymore. So is that part of the reason you can't negotiate? There's no levers.
Well, you can. I mean, the reason why earmarks were gotten rid of was the belief that projects should stand on their merits through the administrative process. So you pass the legislation setting aside money for certain things. And then in a competitive process, contractors or nonprofits, if we're talking about grants, compete with one another, and the winners are determined through the administrative process. So you can still do that, but obviously members like the earmarks because they were able to directly get credit for delivering those projects.
One more thing,
pork does grease the wheels a little bit. There's no doubt about it, and it may well be that if you want to unclog a legislative process that seems to be gummed up after last week, that you do try to go with the infrastructure legislation.
Democrat.
Funny enough, though, it really hasn't been a particularly a thing that Trump has pushed as hard as he did in the campaign. It really does seem to have taken a back seat to Obamacare repeal and tax reform.
Democrats, many have said that they will filibuster the appointment of Neil Gorsuch to be the next Supreme Court justice because of the Republicans' treatment of Merrick Garland, who was Obama's appointment. And they refused to hold hearings because Obama was had one year left on his presidency, and they thought that was not fair to let him appoint somebody. Well, now we have a president who's under investigation. And some Democrats have pointed out that the investigation of Trump and Trump aides over possible collusion with Russia is something that says we should not approve any Trump initiatives until that investigation is cleaned up and we know precisely what the outcome is going to be. Can they do that? Can they be successful doing that? Do they have the power to do that?
Well, if you keep the threshold in the Senate at 60 votes, yeah, because Republicans only have 52 and they have to get Democrats. And if Democrats are more solidified and together on certain things, that is the possibility. There is also the flip side of the nuclear option coming into effect. And that would be the Republicans, if they can't get Neil Gorsuch, decide, you know what, we don't need a 60-vote threshold. We only need 50 votes or 51. And that could further destroy the institution of the Senate and the possibility for both sides to be working together.
Well, and two things going on. I think we see this in North Carolina, but tit-for-tat politics.
Yeah. Yeah.
You did that to us. We're going to do it to you. And I do think at some point the Senate at least seems to have some concern with the institution and changing precedent, not precedent, but going to the nuclear option and saying, okay, we're going to really change the rules to slip in someone. Senators really have some respect for the institution. And I think that's one of the things that if you look at that and the changes, you're going to see some real issues about governance and where we're going to go. And maybe that will be the new normal, and that will be not very safe or happy.
And senators know that one day they may be in the majority, the next after the next election, they could be in the minority. But this revenge, you know, retribution kind of politics is really seeping deep within the body.
And is there a danger? We have this problem with the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Nunez, going to the president and telling him things that that people say ethically he shouldn't have done before telling his own committee. Are they not walking a fine line with this? I mean, if they don't act on the up and up completely, if the Republicans don't act on the up and up with this investigation completely, if something goes wrong in this investigation and it goes against Donald Trump or it goes against key members of his administration, could this not hurt them politically if they don't play right down the middle of the road?
I think a lot of this is separation of powers issues and questions. And yeah, if the Republicans are looking like they are aiding or assisting the president and something develops in a grander scheme, there will be some real questions asked and there will be some hard facts come the next election.
This week, let's move to North Carolina. This week, the NCAA is likely to vote on the locations for their championship games through 2022. And they have said unequivocally that if HB2 stays on the books in North Carolina, none of those games will be played here. Now, none of the games this year were played here. Neither was the NBA All-Star game, and the legislature doesn't seem to know this. And Charlotte mayoral candidate State Senator Joel Fort came up with a compromise plan, which was essentially the same plan that Phil Berger came up with months ago, that initially Roy Cooper said he would support because he's looking for a way out. But then Roy Cooper met with I can't remember the name of the organization.
Equality
NC. And then it changed his mind. So what is the state of this bill? Is that bill still on the table, Joel Ford's bill?
Well, I need to say, I mean, I read in The Observer, I have not talked to Joel Ford about this, but he was quoted as saying, I really can't believe that the Republicans met in secret to discuss this without Democrats. I was incredulous. Of course they're going to meet without Democrats there. I think this is another reason why, if you look at the money lost and the companies that haven't come here, again, and then you add in the other ingredient, perception of what North Carolina has stood for so long as a progressive state. Maybe, you know, if the Tar Heels win, people say, I'd like to have gone in North Carolina to watch them. I'd like to have watched some of the games. I think it's the NCAA aside, this is an issue that will plague North Carolina for years to come.
There's a new report from the Associated Press that there are estimates now that HB2 could cost the state more than $3.76 billion, with a B, billion dollars in lost business over a dozen years. But then South Carolina had that NAACP boycott for years over the Confederate flag. I'm sure it wasn't $3.76 billion, but maybe it was close. I don't know.
Yeah.
The legislature doesn't seem to care. They seem to be denying the facts of the loss of business and the loss of relocations of businesses, the loss of jobs, etc.
I think there are two things. One is to go back to Andy's point about trust. There is no trust between Republicans and Democrats, or very little, to be exercised and worked off of. The other thing is Republicans are based primarily in rural legislative districts. They like HB2. They want support for HB2 to stay, and they want HB2 on the books.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into urban areas, it's mostly Democratic legislators who are in the distinct minority because both chambers are supermajority legislative controlled by the Republicans. They can override Governor Cooper's veto at any point in time if they hold their caucuses together. This is we're in a stalemate.
So there's nothing. I mean, if the loss of jobs is not important, if the loss of money to the tune of $3.76 billion is not a motivator, if the loss of prestige or the loss of marketing ability to say what a great state North Carolina is in some people's minds, if that doesn't do anything and there's this lack of trust,
well,
is this the new normal?
Excuse me. I just want to say it very simply. It's a matter of framing. And that will really defeat anything that goes with the numbers or the jobs. And that is, it's almost like the Titanic. Women and children first. This is going to be the shower bill and these sorts of things. And that really plays well. It's one of those divisive cultural issues that's played up in polarization. I don't think it's going away.
Andrew Taylor.
Yeah, no, I think some of the estimates about the cost of the legislation are exaggerated. We've seen some alternative costs, but nevertheless, there is going to be a financial cost to this. And I do think members care about it, even those who support HB2. What is needed is an opportunity to provide face saving for people who have hardened positions on both sides. Just have some kind of compromise that allows people to say we won. And that is proving difficult. Now, we've had sort of three efforts at this now, starting with that sort of phantom special session in December. You mentioned the Ford proposal. We had a proposal before that as well, which was essentially the same one. I think we're getting closer. I think both sides are kind of trying to feel out whether their bases will accept some kind of compromise. But as you noted, Mike, the clock is ticking as far as some deadlines are concerned. And we still aren't at that stage where there is face-saving all around. That's what's needed.
The legislature just overrode Governor Cooper's veto of judicial partisan elections, a bill that they passed in the legislature. He said no to because he said you shouldn't politicize the judiciary, and Republicans have said voters should know what they're getting when they vote for people running for judge. Who's right on this?
Well, this is one method by which you can select judges. There are various methods out there, the partisan elections. The question becomes, can judges promote or campaign on a certain set of partisan values when they should be operating in a case-by-case environment.
They don't necessarily have to campaign on it. They would just have an R or a D next to their name on the ballot.
But in our environment, and particularly with the voting patterns that I've been watching in North Carolina, if you vote Republican at the presidential level, you're voting Republican down the ballot. Same thing for Democrats. So there is true partisan loyalty in our voters nowadays.
So
I think voters sometimes look for cues.
Yeah.
And if you had a RRD by the name,
you
have to really find out, what are they? Are they really Republican? Right. Are they really Democrats? People ask me all the time at election time.
So David emails, and we only have about a minute left. David emails, how will switching to partisan judge elections affect jurisprudence? And will the switch favor one party over another? Because State Senator Jeff Tart has said one goal is to elect more Republican judges.
And his proposal splits, for example, Mecklenburg County into three districts.
Right.
The districts are tending to trend towards one party over the other.
So in states where this is already done, and we used to be one of those states where we had the designation on the ballot about what political party a candidate for judge was running. What's the difference? Do we have any empirical evidence that it does sway people to a party line vote?
There is some evidence that people, all other things being held equal, prefer Republicans as judges because the Republican Party has a reputation for being stronger in law and order. Just as Democrats are often preferred in, for example, in school board elections because the Democrats are seen as a stronger party on education. So there is some evidence that it's going to, all other things being equal, should benefit the Republicans.
Dr. Andrew Taylor is professor of political science at North Carolina State University. Dr. Susan Roberts with us today from Davidson College, where she is also a professor of political science, as is Michael Bitzer. How did this happen? With Catawba College, all three of them here. Thank you very much for the hour.